Welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn.
It used to be that the main activity of an evening would be that the young people would gather around the old people, and the old people would tell stories about life in the wilderness and about the history of their culture. And now that the TV set was on, the young people and the old people are just watching Dallas, you know.
It's interesting to talk about new technologies bursting onto the scene, but do we realize that we must think about technology and its impact on our lives? Can we learn about how technology affects us by looking at other societies? Jerry Mander is a senior fellow at the nation's only not-for-profit advertising agency, the Public Media Center, and he's author of the book, In the Absence of the Sacred, The Failure of Technology and the Survival of the Indian Nations.
A more powerful computer is actually easier to use, so that really the people who know the least about computers need the most powerful systems.
You've heard him before on public radio, on All Things Considered, and on John Dvorak's Software Hard Talk. With extensive background in computers and microcomputers, Fred Davis has been editor-in-chief of a number of noted personal computer magazines, including Mac User. Fred's most recent book is The Windows 3.1 Bible. He speaks with Moira about his perspectives on computers. And now, here's Moira with Jerry Mander.
Your book has a grand theme. You see a technological society engulfing the earth, and at the same time, you see, against amazing odds, the continued survival of native peoples and their culture throughout the entire world. What does the technological society have to learn from native peoples?
The book is really about how technological society lost touch with a sense of relationship to the earth, and that this breakdown of this relationship has caused us to do many things that seem sane to us through our set of paradigms that we think and see the world through, and when actually they're crazy, and that many of our technological choices and the way we're organizing economies and the way the relationships that we have to nature are expressed are actually of such a kind that they're doing in the earth and causing us great trauma, as we know from rainforest destruction and ozone holes and breakdowns in community life as well. I mean, the entire social and ecological system are in crisis at this time. And the book argues that basically it's the fact of our separation from a nature-based information, our separation from the planet, and our realization of our connection to it are really the root cause of the problem. On the other hand, native people on the planet, of whom there are still many dozens of millions, all over the planet, from the far north of the Arctic to the tropical regions of the Borneo and throughout Asia and the Pacific and around the world in Africa and so on, many of these native peoples have not lost this connection that we have and remain close to nature and conscious of that, of the importance of learning from the natural world and appreciating one's sense of appropriate place in it. So the most important thing we need to learn is that point. That's the main thing we could learn from natives. What we can learn about medicines in the forest and so on is just sort of icing on the cake. If we learn the first thing, we'll learn the second thing. We get the second thing free.
Yeah. Every time I order that strawberry milkshake, I get the whipped cream and the cherry. I've noticed that.
Exactly.
Now, throughout the book, and just in what you've said here, whether you're talking about technology or you're talking about Native American life or world events, the theme is balance. Balance with the natural world versus imbalance. How do we tell when we're in balance and short of catastrophe, out of balance? What are those earmarks?
I mean, how do we tell personally?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. The book doesn't really deal on that level, although I have my own opinions, of course, on how we can tell personally. What the book states is that we need to develop a way of approaching the instruments that we live with, mainly the technologies that we live with. And these include everything as apparently benign as your toaster and your fax machine to your automobile and television set and computer and the personal kinds of technologies that you have, but also the other technologies, the transpersonal technologies, you might say, such as satellite communications and laser technology and robotics and genetics and space travel and so on, those, that scale of technology, you better learn how to think about also. And by learning a system for how to think about them, the book offers various ways of organizing your thoughts, you might say, about how to view these technologies, most important of which is don't view them from what they how they benefit you. That is to say, just because your TV offers some nice programs doesn't mean that TV is a good thing to have on the planet. And just because you can edit your copy quickly on your computer, which you certainly can do, and just because it helps you communicate with other friendly computer people out there in the world, doesn't mean that computers are necessarily a good thing because they benefit you. The most important way of looking at computers is, what else do they do in the world? You know, who else do they benefit? Who do they benefit most? And the book analyzes that as being the largest, you know, transnational corporations and the largest governments and the military and so on. That's who basically gains an advantage by the introduction of computers. And we're seeing that reflected in the destruction of the Earth. So the book tries to offer kind of a checklist, a sort of checklist on how you can tend to look at technology. Then how you view your own relationship to it is something I don't know how to tell people to do that. I do think they need to review it, and they need to come to ask themselves questions about their relationship to technology. And they need to look at their kids watching television and decide something about that. Is that a good thing? Is it a partly good thing? Is, to what extent is it a bad thing? How do you feel about it? What do you want them to continue to do that? Do you want them to do it a lot less? How are you going to go about that? What does it all mean? How are they turning out because of that? Who's speaking into their brains because of that? Who is directing their thoughts and viewpoints? And so you have to think of all that. Now, maybe you want to keep it at that point. That's fine. But you have to make that process real in your life and appreciate that that process is affecting your own family life and your own relationship to yourself, but it also has bigger relationships, political, social, economic relationships, dealing with power on the planet and relationship to the universe and so on.
Everybody always says, well, you know, well, technology, TV is technology and that type of thing. And when we talk about this program, people often say to me, well, you know, what kinds of technologies do you get into? And I say, well, that's easy. You know, our definition of technology is, if God didn't make it, you know, it's technology. So that's the way we look at it. It's
if very it doesn't grow or walk.
Huh? Yeah, you got it.
Or swim.
Oh, rocks, that's not technology. Break them up, you put them on your driveway, that's technology. You know, this is what we look at. And when we look at it that way, clearly there are no societies or civilizations by any definition that doesn't have technology. I mean, there's housing and there's tools and that type of thing. When we look at native cultures, how can their technology work when often our industrialized society's technology can work against the society?
I think that native societies have a value system and a relationship to nature which is such that they try to find help from tools only that are consistent with that relationship. In other words, they're not trying to build spaceships or, you know what I mean? I think that they would find that a foolish endeavor. In fact, I know that's the case. And they might like to use some piece of technology that would sort of fit into their lifestyle. I mean, Indians will certainly go for a rifle when it's presented to shoot the animal, you know, 400 yards away instead of having to run after it. They'll go for water-moving equipment sometimes, so they'll go for mirrors and axes and things like that. I mean, so speaking of Native people who were in the early stages of contact. But, of course, that's because they, just as we, don't get the full picture of these things. We don't know when the thing is presented what the full consequences of it are. You know, we don't know that if you hunt with a rifle or you irrigate your water or irrigate your farms or you, you know, use an axe instead of the older way or you listen to the radio or get TV broadcasts into your village, that this will change everything. It doesn't seem like that. It just seems like a useful tool. So people haven't learned to think about technology systemically, not even the Native people never having faced with it. Now they know exactly what to think about, how to capture animals and do things like that that are related to their world. But they didn't invent these other things that were brought in. They only invented things that were consistent with their environment. Now, we invent things according to whether they may be made to be profitable or not. That is to say, the reason we invent things is, well, scientists theoretically in some institution are inventing things or dreaming of things for the intrinsic value of those things. But there are few and far between among those scientists right now, since most of them are salaried by corporate funding to their institutions, and are more and more scientists who are engaged actually in entrepreneurship, such as the genetic scientists who started all these big new companies. But the main driving force is not to create good. The main driving force of creation and invention in Western society is to make money. That's related to capitalism, of course. This wouldn't have to be the case in, let's say, socialist societies, not intrinsically part of socialist societies, although they've adopted the same behavior basically because of the same sort of Western paradigms of progress that we carry. So I mean, I think that describes an important relationship to the use of technology. Native people will use it only in concert with what is already there, unless it's brought in from the outside, in which case they're as dumb about it as we are. Whereas we use it for the purpose of making profit, in which case we don't even take into account questions of how it might affect the earth or how it might affect our communities or anything. That's nothing to do with it. It's all about, can I make money from it?
Now, what I get from what you've been saying, and from your book as well, but I think what's key in the words you've just been using, is that there is a link between examining consequences to technology and being committed to that, but also doing it in terms of values and saying, wait a minute, what are my values and what are societal values that maybe need to be there independent of my personal values? I think that's a very, very important thing. This is, gee, how do we and how do I personally think about this in both what I do and what do I accept in my environment? Let's talk about what I always call the big sell, the pro-technology paradigm that you write about.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us some about that.
You know, it's funny that the paradigm of being in favor of technology is now so pervasive that it reflects itself off every single thing that we encounter. I mean, almost all of society, of American society, and mostly Western society, is run by and dominated by corporations. So, I mean, almost all experiences that we have are corporation-related in our society. We buy clothes, we get in a car, we go down a street, which is all yelling at us from signs, and we use products, and we work in a place, and over 90% of the country that's not working in the government is working for a corporation. And all of our activities, and then we watch television where corporate images are fed into us constantly. And if we're watching an average amount of television, we get 21,000 corporate images per year, all giving us the same worldview. That's a very important mental implantation. But we've been at this now for a sufficient number of generations, probably most importantly since the Second World War, at this domination of images by the corporate scientific Western world viewpoint, which cherishes and celebrates and tries to sell us as much technology as it possibly can, and therefore presents this technology from an absolutely favorable point of view at all times. All of our introduction to technology is presented to us in the most idealistic terms, the best case scenarios for each thing. We always hear about all the benefits of the technology and how wonderful it's going to be without ever hearing any of the potential downsides of it. That's because the corporations who manufacture it and the scientists who work on it don't really have an economic stake and are hearing the downside of some of these technologies. In fact, the only technology that I know of that we ever heard the downside of early on was nuclear energy, because in the moment of its introduction, it blew up 80,000 people. So we knew there was a downside on that one.
And
from then on, they've had a hard time making us think it's good, because we began with the down, and now we're always a little worried about nuclear, whatever they tell us about it. But for most technologies, we never get an inkling of the negative side. We never knew that television would organize society the way it has and turn all campaigning into TV campaigning and break up, have people sitting in separate rooms and have people not experiencing the rest of their lives and gaining all information through television. Maybe we like that, but the point is we never knew about all that beforehand. Nobody told us the full picture. And automobiles, they were introduced as, private, safe, clean, comfortable, non-polluting. That's the way they were. Nobody told us that we'd have the paving of the entire country. We'd have all of life organized around cities. We'd have smog and solid waste problems. We'd have oil wars. We'd have... no one ever told us that society would completely change from them. And they had no stake in telling us that. So all they always tell us are the best-case scenarios, and we're living in a world of best-case scenarios. But they don't actually work out that way. In most cases, the technology doesn't produce as advertised, and we become disappointed, and yet it has its effects on society in any case. We don't really think about society at all, about technology at all, because we're so far inside it. In the book I pointed out is its pervasiveness makes it kind of invisible. We are so inside technological corporate life that we're like the fish in the water. We never see outside our environment to know what it is that we are living inside, or that there are any ways of thinking about it that are alternate to it. And another important point is that we tend to take a personal view. I spoke of this a little early. If a computer helps us do our work, and helps us keep track of things and so on, we think it's good. And this is normal to think that. It'd be very hard. You do experience the world by your experience of it. But it's harder to realize that computers have created a much higher level of surveillance and police control, and in the office work, counting of the keystrokes on the typewriters. And most of the toxic waste dumps in the United States are from computers, from the process of manufacturing and disposing of computer materials. And a lot of people getting sick from using computers. And, computers speed up the speed of life at a very, very incredible rate. And I think it's making people nervous. And it's making corporations more dominant than they were before because of their introduction. They have an ability to move resources around the world and act faster and bigger and more wide scale than ever before because of the introduction of computers. And it's changed warfare. It's made warfare much more fast and dangerous and spectacular. And, there's a lot of more I could say about computers, but I'm just trying to make the point that there's another side to their use besides the one that we relate to personally.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, and I'm Dr. Moira Gunn. My guest today is Jerry Mander, author of In the Absence of the Sacred, The Failure of Technology and the Survival of the Indian Nations. Jerry, before you wrote this book, you wrote a well-known treatise on four arguments for the elimination of television. And I have to say that I was struck throughout when I was reading this book by my personal experience and how it related to much of what you were saying. I thought when I watched television, basically it was coming into my living room, and I was seeing it, and I remember being in my late 20s, And it was at that point that I was sent by NASA around to about six different cities in the United States. You know, one of those See America First studies where you go and you talk to all these people. And no matter what hotel I went into, I'd turn on the television set, and everything would be the same. The same schedules, the same programs, the same cartoons, the same commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, I'd be in a large city. In other cases, I would be in absolutely nowhere. And it was until I physically moved and saw the same image and the same medium going everywhere that I realized it was going everywhere.
Mm.
And that sameness was there.
What an important observation. Yeah.
And it was as if I wanted to go home and I wanted to take mm-hmm. every person I know and send them on this trip and say, mm-hmm. just walk into this room and turn on the set.
Not only that, but the room itself is the same as everywhere else.
Oh, yeah.
If it was a Holiday Inn.
Yeah.
See, the drive of commodity society is for homogeneity, and television is the main delivery system for that. Television is the instrument that puts the same images into all of the brains in the country at the same time and does it over and over and over again. People sitting in their dark rooms night after night, and they're having these images pour in, and they're all getting the same image, and so their minds are all occupied by the same thing, and slowly they turn more and more into each other. And they have the same interests, the same values, the same knowledge. They're all becoming each other. So television is definitely an instrument to wipe out diversity of thought and diversity of culture. But more important than our experience here in this country is the experience of television's movement around the world, because this is happening everywhere now. Everywhere it's the same. You can be in a village in Borneo with grass houses and no roads, and satellite TV is coming in. About 70% of the world now is getting these same programs, not at the same time, but the same Western commercial broadcast content is going into these places, and people are sitting in these grass houses on a beach someplace, and they're watching Dallas. You know, they're watching people in Dallas drinking and standing by their swimming pool and, stealing from each other. And I had that very experience of being in the far north of Canada not long ago, and being in a native culture up in the Arctic Circle region where television was just arriving, and actually seeing how it impacted that society. And they're very aware of it, though, fortunately, and they're trying to resist it quite a bit. But it's amazing how quickly homogenized tastes and thought and culture become through that instrument. But yeah, there's one thing that happened that I experienced in the north, which is that this is a culture up there. These are the Dene people and the Inuit people from the Mackenzie River Valley. And this is a 4,000-year-old culture there in that place. And they still, there's no roads in that region at all, and they still hunt with dog teams, and they fish on the ice, and all these things are around, and they live communally in log houses. Very traditional culture still happening in that region. And the Canadian government's trying to install television sets in the places, and a lot of the communities are saying no, but some of them have said yes. And one of the worst results of that has been that storytelling has stopped. It used to be that the main activity of an evening would be that the young people would gather around the old people, and the old people would tell stories about life in the wilderness and about the history of their culture and how to be. And, these are teaching systems in places like that. And now that the TV set was on, the young people and the old people are just watching Dallas, and getting fed an entirely different value system. And the storytelling, which was the main way that first of all the young contacted the old, beautiful nurturing happened in that manner, and it was also the way the young people could see through their eyes to the past, as being Indian, get a sense of what it means to be Indian. And the stories themselves taught how to be on the earth. And now all that's wiped out by TV.
Well, speaking of the oral tradition, you describe speaking with Orin Lyons of the Iroquois Nation, and he points out that the Great Law is essentially an oral law and will remain that way. In 1974, the Grand Council rejected all written versions. I have to say, one of the first things people say when they get the computer is, now we can write all this down.
Yeah.
What can we learn from the Iroquois about this?
Oh, well, the Iroquois are fabulous. They have, I have a whole chapter in the book about the Iroquois because they have the most elaborate, highly developed civilization that has since, has yet to appear on this North American continent. I don't know about all the other native cultures, but they're very, very remarkable. Most of that chapter is devoted to the Iroquois Constitution, that's to say the great law that you were speaking about. And it was at one time written down, and we can read it. And, of course, Oren says it was an inaccurate recording because you can't record an oral tradition because it's never the same from one speaking to the next. But the basic principles remain the same. And those principles are which there's plenty of evidence to believe now from scholars, are the basis of the U.S. Constitution, primarily because at the time of the invention of this of the U.S. Constitution, we're speaking about the late 1700s, these cities that we think of as cities like Albany and New York and Philadelphia were actually hamlets. The biggest city in the colonies at that time, I believe, was Albany, and it had some under 10,000 people. And everything between Albany and Philadelphia was woods. And, you know,
woods?
There was New York City, and there were a few hamlets along, but basically between Albany and Philadelphia, which were the two biggest cities, it was forest. And living in those forests were Indians, their whole territory. And so the colonists had plenty of contact with those Indians. They needed to have a lot of contact with those Indians just to get through the forest and to make deals and to influence each other. At that time, it was a pretty equal relationship. And so the colonists knew a lot about how the Indians related to the world, and they knew a lot about Indian governance systems. And the Iroquois Confederacy had already existed for several hundred years, that is to say, a confederacy of separate nations, seven nations. The Iroquois is a confederacy of seven separate different nations, and it functions in an entirely democratic model with a two-house legislature and local governments as well as centralized governments and rules about which form, you know, what level the political action should take place and states' rights and...
And this is all oral.
This is all oral. It's very, very long. Takes hundreds of pages to record. And the U.S. was busy trying to get, the colonists were busily trying to get away from England and trying to figure out how to govern themselves. And they wanted to, there were these noises in Europe about democracy from people, you know, from various people. And, but they had no models of it. There had been no models of it since the Greeks, and that depended on slavery. So, it was democracy for everybody but the 50% slave population. And there were the Indians who were doing it already. They were actually doing it, and they were happy to explain it. And they were present at all the meetings which took place to discuss what kind of constitution. There's recorded evidence of Indians taking place, and there's recorded evidence of Benjamin Franklin making a speech to the effect that, you know, we see what they're doing, and if they can do it, why can't we do it? And that to that effect. And so there's, and then when you compare the U.S. Constitution with the Iroquois Constitution, it's almost the same, with a few startling differences, but such as universal suffrage, which the U.S. didn't get for another 100 years, but the Indians already had. But so it's obvious that the U.S. Constitution really is rooted in the Iroquois thought, political thought. And yet it's not acknowledged. I mean, during the bicentennial celebration of the U.S. Constitution, it wasn't ever mentioned anywhere, even though some people were trying to get it noticed. It would be too much for the U.S. to admit that our founding fathers were probably Indians. But the Iroquois are remarkable in very many ways, socially, politically, you know, very remarkable people. And they're still going. They still have their traditional governments operating on many of the reservations.
Moira's first guest has been Jerry Mander. He's the author of the book, In the Absence of the Sacred, The Failure of Technology and the Survival of the Indian Nations. It's published by Sierra Club Books and is now available in paperback. You're listening to Tech Nation. Americans and Technology, with Dr. Moira Gunn. Fred Davis. Does that name sound familiar? You've heard Fred on All Things Considered and on Dvorak Software Hard Talk. He's been the editor-in-chief of Mac User, and his most recent book is the Windows 3.1 Bible. Fred speaks with Moira about the field of personal computers.
You're completely enmeshed in the personal computer industry. From a user standpoint or a consumer standpoint, what are the most important things to understand about personal computers today?
Oh, boy. The most important thing to understand is that they're impossible to understand. So to answer with a circular question. Personal computers are a force that is in the process of changing the world in just about every area of human endeavor. So to sum it up in 5,000 words or less is probably more than I can think about at one shot. You know, a couple things off the top of my head. It's still in the infancy stage. This is a technology in its very earliest infancy. We ain't seen nothing yet. It's still too hard to use. It still doesn't work right the way it should. It's rife with problems and incompatibilities and headaches that poor customers shouldn't have to struggle with at all. But because the industry is evolving so rapidly, there's just no way around it. If we want to get the latest, greatest benefit, it means putting up with the latest, greatest incompatibility and struggle.
Your most recent book, The Windows 3.1 Bible, was exceptionally well reviewed. The New York Times said, toss the other Windows books out. Now let's talk about that book.
Oh, wow. Yeah, thank you, New York Times and Peter Lewis. That was an amazing quote, and certainly felt a little vindicated after devoting 2 years of my life to wrestling through this horrible, hideous Windows interface and all the ugly things underneath it in terms of the technical demons that lurk inside your system, really with the goal to make it understandable for the average person so that it could get back to what they bought the computer for in the first place rather than having to become a computer scientist.
Well, not everybody sort of knows what Windows is. I mean, we're used to hearing, well, do you have Windows on that or does it run with Windows? Why don't you explain for some people who haven't heard about what it is, just what Windows is?
Windows is, in nerd speak, what we call a graphical user interface. And what that's all about is an effort on behalf of computer manufacturers to make computers people literate so that people don't have to spend too much of their time becoming computer literate. The whole idea of teaching computer literacy in school was nutso. I thought, yeah, it's part of math and science, but as a fourth R, no way. Computers should be a transparent tool that just help us in our creative endeavors or work or whatever. So I think graphical user interfaces speak to that by using a graphical metaphor of our own desktop for arranging the things that we work with on the computer so that there are little icons that represent pieces of paper or tools that we might use on our desk or in the case of the Macintosh, which is the best known graphical user interface and I think the best implemented, there's a little trash can. So we can take a little piece of paper from our desk and we want to get rid of it, we put it in the trash can. We know how trash cans work. We know that when we want to throw something away, we put it in the trash. So there's nothing complex or mystical or technical about that. And to have the computer become people literate and work in a metaphor and a way that people work is just going to open it up to many, many more people. Not very many people want to become computer literate, only scientists and mathematicians and folks like that. And I think for average people, a graphical user interface like Windows or the Mac or Solaris, Next Step, OSF Motif, there's a whole handful of them. But one of these graphical user interfaces is clearly a necessary item unless you are an engineer or scientist and enjoy that sort of stuff, which there are some people that do.
Now, in the very early 80s, when the first personal computers came out, everybody was typing in lines in CPM or DOS and all that stuff. And then when the Macintosh came out, that graphical easy user interface really was the first one that people saw on a consumer basis. And I remember the TV ads at the time. They would show like an IBM PC or something like that, and they'd drop all these manuals, and then they'd show you the Macintosh and this little manual. It would get dropped down on the table. So you don't need it. It's all visual. And they said, ooh, what's IBM going to do? What everybody going to do? And they developed this software, like the Windows, which I guess is the most popular for for the IBM title?
Yeah, I think calling them the IBM PC-compatible world is probably a misnomer at this point.
Uh-huh.
It's really an Intel-Microsoft world. IBM is now a bit player in their own marketplace, unfortunately for them. But the sort of Intel-Microsoft world, certainly Windows is an amazing seller. 1.5 million copies a month. I mean,
a month.
Yeah, soon they're going to be saying, wow, hotcakes, they're selling like Windows.
That would be great. That would be great. Now, in the Intel part of that, the Intel people provide the chip, which mm-hmm. is the base, then you've got this casing, and the Microsoft people provide the software, which implements that Windows. And I guess there's some support from some of the hardware, so it looks nice, and we can color and things like that, and resolution. But you said there are other interfaces as well.
Yeah, I rattled a few of them off earlier. I mean, the Macintosh and Windows are the two big ones because they've shipped over 10 million units in each one of those.
And do they look relatively the same?
Well, surprisingly the same. And in fact, if you talk to Apple's lawyers, uncomfortably the same. there's been a multi-year lawsuit between Apple and Microsoft on interface protection for the Macintosh, which I think is undeserved, by the way. This whole argument boils down to Apple came out with the Macintosh and shipped one of the very first machines before it was even introduced up to Microsoft because they wanted Microsoft to create programs for it. Microsoft saw this and said, wow, what a good idea. Let's bring this to the world of PCs where we create the operating system as well in partnership with IBM. And that's just what they did. Back in 1983, Bill Gates got up and said, hey, we're going to have this thing called Interface Manager, and it's going to be just like the Mac for DOS, and actually licensed some Apple technology to implement that. Well, the license expired, and Apple decided they'd get tough with their legal department, and they didn't want Windows to imitate the Mac too closely. They didn't want that kind of flattery, I guess, and had an army of lawyers go out and tell Microsoft, oh, you nasty, horrible people, you stole this from us. Well, it turned out Apple stole it from Xerox, so it was sort of the pot calling the kettle black. And on a broader term, copyright was never meant to protect ideas or function. In fact, it specifically excludes that protection. But the poor legal system in America has all sorts of problems, one of which is it's not addressed to technical concerns. And judges don't have good guidance, and they end up making laws instead of interpreting them. And that's a disaster for the industry. So there's some precedent on look and feel, and Apple decides they'll sue Microsoft because Windows looks and feels like the Mac. Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, imagine if every telephone maker decided that that touch tone phone arrangement on your telephone was their look and feel, and every phone had to have a different layout of those numbers. We'd have a hard time dialing numbers, or if every calculator had a different arrangement of its keys, or if every car had a different standard transmission layout for the gears, we'd be grinding them all the way down the highway. So we'd wind up in a world where we couldn't make phone calls or drive a car. And that's where we are with computers today. These guys are so aggressively protecting the ideas behind their interface that it's hurting the average user. And copyright was never meant to do that. Copyright was supposed to help people move forward and give just enough protection so that people have their financial interests protected. And I think, you know, Apple has a set of software in the Macintosh that if you ripped off that software, that would be illegal. If you imitate it, that should be just fine.
Who would be interested in getting a Windows 3.1 Bible?
Well, I mean, I wrote this to
other than absolutely everybody, Fred.
Right. Well, I sort of wrote this for the average business person, not for the computer wizard. There are other books out about Windows if you're a programmer or far along the path. You'd find this handy because I dug up a lot of little tips and tricks that even an expert wouldn't know. But it's really meant to be for the average business person or creative artist, because now musicians and artists are also getting interested in computers as a creativity tool, not just as a business productivity tool, and that's an exciting thing. So here we've got a lot of average folks who want to get the computer to just do their work, to write a letter, to paint a picture, to write a musical composition, and they don't know the bits and the bytes and the buzzwords and so forth, and Windows was sold to them as something that made your computer easier to use. Well, it makes it easier, but it doesn't make it easy. And so what I've tried to do is spell out in plain English for the average person what is all this stuff all about, and also give you some sensibilities about it. Microsoft has a way of telling you about things that favors them, and so does every other company. So I try to take a step back from the industry and all of its frenetic competitiveness and from the buzzwords that just plague you, and sort of create what I call structured learning. This was a very hard sell to when I was creating the book and outselling it to publishers because they wanted a tight positioning. They said, well, is this a programming book or an entry-level book or whatever? And I said, well, it's a book that's going to teach you about Windows. It's going to start assuming that you know very little other than what the screen is and where to touch things on the keyboard, and then teach you things, and as you go along, build on the concepts that you've learned and essentially provide a course in understanding Windows on your computer. And that sort of educational approach is missing from a lot of books, which turn out to look more like rehashed versions of the manual than anything that really provides added value.
Was that, you said you had some difficulty. I mean, how much difficulty did you have in getting it?
Well, darn, I went through a couple of publishers on this one. And with one publisher in particular, we had a major creative struggle, where as a sort of, yeah, I view myself as an artist, and I get a creative idea. And the way I express my art is in writing, or in this case, talking, as we are now, or some kind of verbal communication. So I said, well, wouldn't it be great for all, I thought of sort of all my relatives who call me up on the phone late at night, going, Fred, oh gosh, my hard disk has crashed, or I can't figure out how to get this program installed. And I think, you know, in the previous years, it was the doctor in your family got all these calls from family members. Oh, doc, my sacroiliac, you know, can you help me out? Now it's the computer nerd. We're getting calls all night long. Sometimes I think I should have 1-900-ASK-FRED and tell all my friends to call me there. So I said, well, the only way out of this is to tell people to read a good book. So I went into the bookstore and I said, well, gosh, you could get, you know, there really isn't anything that's going to be suitable for you. So I sat down to outline what that would be like and went around to some publishers. I've done about 10 computer books. I did the first book on desktop publishing, and back then people went, desktop what? I've had this problem before. And Windows was only just getting started, and I knew to really do it right would take a long time, so I need somebody who will be with me for the duration. And I have another problem, which is I don't like writing books about beta software, where the software's never been in the market for sale. And publishers put pressure on you to have the book ready so that when Windows 3.1 ships, there's like 20 other books about Windows 3.1. Well, none of those authors, they had to have ever talked to a real user because it hasn't been in the marketplace. And they haven't gained real experience about what it's like. So I told the publisher, well, I want to wait till the product ships. I want to be really careful about this, take a long time, and have the best book, not necessarily the first one or whatever. And that met with some resistance. Then describing the project, that it's structured learning, and I have this whole idea about taking computer books to a new level. I've done 10 of them the old-fashioned way, and now I want a new challenge. And rather than just do yet another computer book, I wanted to do something really special because I thought, heck, it's a point in my career where I can sort of be courageous and see my vision out to its final product. Unfortunately, getting that across to some publishers is a tough business because they have a very traditional way of looking at things, and it didn't fit in the positioning of their product line and all these other things. So we sort of had a parting of the ways, and I went thinking about the situation again. And there's a little publisher right down the road from me called Peach Pit Press in Berkeley, California, where they really, their books just said something different to me. They had a book called The Mac is Not a Typewriter. And I'm sure that is a book that every major publisher would have turned down. This guy took it on a welfare mother up in Northern California, wrote this, sold 100,000 copies. She got off welfare. I'm sure all the Republicans will be happy to hear about this. And now, you know, she's actually a fairly wealthy person as a computer author. And because this guy had the guts to take a risk on something different. So I said, hey, he's courageous. I'm courageous. Maybe we'll see eye to eye on this. And he instantly signed the project on. And it's worked out well for both of us. It's his best-selling computer book right now.
So I can just imagine what he felt like when he read that New York Times review.
He was really excited. In fact, he called me at midnight. We get the New York Times here late at night in California, and he called me at midnight. I happened to be awake, a little bit of a night owl nerd type, and he was raving about it. It certainly made our month, let alone our day.
That's right. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Fred Davis, computer industry observer, writer, and among other things. His most recent book is The Windows 3.1 Bible. Fred, when you were young, your father was an IBM fellow, and he was in computers before it was fashionable to be in computers. Now everyone is in computers. What opportunities did this afford you?
Well, actually, it sort of got me hooked. I tell people my mom was an English teacher and my dad was an IBM lifer, so I was sort of raised from birth to write about computers. When I was a little kid, I played with crayons drawing on punch cards and computer printouts and things like that. I would go by the office and see the latest IBM technology and all of those things. So I sort of wowed as a little kid from almost a sci-fi futuristic thing. And then I had the incredible good fortune when I was 11 to be approached by these two fellows at Dartmouth, Kimony and Kurtz, who had created a new computer language called BASIC. And the idea behind BASIC, which is still with us today, the original concept was to see if it was possible to create a computer language that was simple enough for kids to learn. Well, no kids were going to Dartmouth, where these professors were creating BASIC, so they were looking at schools in New England where there might be some kids with a math aptitude that would be interested in this. And wow, did my hand go shooting right up in the air for this one, and I managed to pass all the little math tests and so forth and get accepted into the pilot program. So back in 1966, when I was 11, I got to be one of the pioneer users of BASIC, and I completely understand all these little kid hackers because, you know, when you're young, your mind is not full of a lot of complicated stuff the way you are when you're an adult. So I glommed onto the computer. It became my best buddy. I would be there, you know, 5 hours a day, and all my teachers were either thinking this was wonderful or horrible, depending on your perspective. Humanities types, of course, thought, oh, this is awful. He's relating to the computer instead of people. He's going to become antisocial. He'll never have any friends. He'll be a geeky guy with no ability to communicate to people, only to computers and so forth. And I think the fact that I can write to the average person speaks to the fact that they were wrong and that computers really aren't a cancer on your brain. And it's actually maybe a gymnasium for your brain. But they were really tied back then to the military-industrial complex and there was no personal computing. But what this BASIC pilot program did was it let me use a mainframe as if it were a personal computer. I wrote my own little programs in BASIC and little computer games and whatever, and I had that experience of personal computing way before it was even technically feasible. So in the late 70s, there were these two guys named Steve who dropped out of school, sold their Volkswagen, and started a computer company named after a fruit. And this little Apple computer turned out had BASIC built in. And there was some other little young nerd called Bill Gates who had written a version of BASIC to go inside this Apple II. And I was thinking, well, this is the greatest thing. I could own my own computer and run BASIC, the language that I already knew how to work with and so forth. The Apple II in 1977 had 16K of memory and a little cassette tape drive to it. So it was much different than today's computers. But it got me started in the very earliest phase of personal computing. And I was already an expert at the language that was new to everybody else, so I really had a head start there, and it was an exciting and sort of heady time for us young nerds back then.
No, I'm just saying, nerd and geek, and Fred, you look pretty normal to me. But on
what's
the other
a
hand,
nerd?
Yeah. On the other hand, they can't see me either, so you know, this conversation could go nowhere.
People have a bad image about nerds. I'm trying to, you know, start a nerd pride movement here. It's like there's what I call classic geek mythology: the guy with the pencil protector and the thick glasses with a Band-Aid in the middle and that sort of stuff. You know, that's the old days. That's the military-industrial complex days. You know, now I talk to people like Thomas Dolby or, you know, musicians, Peter Gabriel, people like that, who the computer has become the central tool in their life for music, other media pursuits, video presentations, just everything that they're doing, figuring out which city they're going to be in tomorrow, what have you. So it's really transcended the business engineering community to really touch everybody in the society almost.
You are the U.S. columnist for the Japanese magazine ICOM, Japan's leading computer magazine. Are your columns translated into Japanese, and do you write them differently for them as opposed to an American audience?
Yes and yes. Yes, they are translated into Japanese. My Japanese abilities are not there. I can, you know, say hello and goodbye and where's the bathroom kind of a thing. To write at the level that I'm used to is certainly new translating, and I actually keep the translator honest by having somebody reverse translate it after it's published so that I can make sure they're not misrepresenting me over there inadvertently. Also, their audience is very, very different than ours. What's amazing about Japan is they don't use computers over there. They just make them and sell them. They're not really using them in the same way. I mean, they use them as a game machine or as a home thing or whatever. But, you know, you go to the train station and they stick little pegs in this big thing to figure out your fare. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, good grief, these are the guys who sell us all this hardware and everything. And they put little wooden pegs and plastic pegs into something to figure out our fare schedule. So they really don't use personal computers. Now, there's a real obvious reason for that. The personal computer technology is based on our character set. That's not what they use over there. They have their own character set. Now, the graphical user interface, again, Macintosh and Windows are really opening them up to personal computers because they can handle the graphical characters, not just the, you know, 26 letters of our alphabet and 10 digits that we have in our number system. So that's been a real big push for them. The other thing is very sophisticated about what we're doing. They're selling us a lot of stuff, and they want to know what the trends are, and they're very focused on the future, Taligent and Kaleida and that sort of thing. So I sort of have to assume less computer literacy, less involvement in the technology, a lot of business literacy, and a lot of understanding of what the opportunities are there and how they, as some of the leaders in global manufacturing and other things, are going to essentially be in partnership, an unofficial partnership with the Microsofts and Apples of the world, who are creating the software and operating systems for the hardware that they want to continue to manufacture. So it's a very interesting audience. The other thing that's sort of fun about it is you can sort of do anything because they don't have this finite need. They're into exploring and thinking about what the options are. I can write about Next 1 week and about Windows NT the next week and Kaleida the next time after that. So it's a lot of fun in terms of the diversity. Whereas in the U.S. publications, they tend to find a targeted audience, and then you're giving them the same audience, the same types of messages over and over again.
You are the director of PC Magazine's. You are the director of PC Magazine's testing lab. You could not have written this 1,128-page book by sort of glancing at the Windows software. How did that experience of the test lab help you in writing this new book, Windows 3.1 Bible?
Well, it was absolutely immensely helpful. In fact, I thought of the idea for the book while I was director of the labs over at PC Magazine. We would get about 3,000 to 5,000 products a year to test in there. In fact, the guys at Consumer Reports, who had out for drinks one evening, said that we tested a lot more products than they did, and that they were in awe of what we did in our testing process because, the plain way to state it is, it's a lot more complicated to test a computer than it is to test toothpaste. And although they do test cars, which are coming up to that level of complexity, computers change a lot more frequently than cars do. Their method of operation, it certainly changes a lot more often. So the things that we have to do to test them change a lot more often. The other thing is to really understand the level of complexity inside these systems and the level at which we even struggled at PC Labs to figure out some of the arcane technical settings. I'm thinking, Windows is going to be great, but it's still running on a computer, and you still have to understand things about this computer to figure it out. So that gave me a sort of a perspective, as well as just the insight in having torn apart thousands of computers and knowing how different they are. On the Macintosh side of the universe, everything is much simpler because only Apple Computer manufactures the hardware, and so they have a control over how it's configured. In the IBM PC and compatible universe, hundreds and hundreds of different manufacturers, thousands of different configurations, and in fact, I challenge you to find any two computers that are sort of the same. I look around the office where I am, and they're all different. Somebody has a 386 this with that and the other thing. Somebody else's system has a completely different configuration. Yet the same software has to run on both of these very different systems. So the complexities in getting it up and running are magnified just immensely. And being at the labs and knowing what the solutions were to that, I said, wow, I just can't sit on top of this all the time. And in the magazine format, we don't get a chance to talk about that part of it in the magazine. We're just interested in comparing your printers, and we deliver you some finite information about that. The sort of bigger picture, how does that fit into Windows? What's Windows printing all about? How is that different than DOS or Macintosh printing? Those were the kind of things that were really good for the ordinary average user who's trying to struggle to use their computer that we just didn't have room in the magazine in a 20-page article to get into.
I think what really struck me as a technical person myself is, as I was going through your book, is the detail. You really were looking in every nook and cranny. And the only people I know who really do that are testers. So when I found that in your biography, I said, this is where we got it.
We're also professional cynics and skeptics. The other thing that the labs got me to believe in was, don't believe in them, because they're going to overrepresent more than they will underrepresent. And in fact, there was something I called benchmarksmanship, where people would psych out our benchmarks and they would design their systems. I mean, even a company like Compaq, I caught them at this, putting certain things in the system design that there was really no benefit to the user, but it did give it a better benchmark test result. And I'm thinking to myself, well, wait a minute, just because it's getting a better benchmark result, if it's not delivering any benefit to the user, this is wrong. You're essentially trying to get out and cheat people by misleading them in what you're doing with your technology. So it really made us especially ever vigilant to these little tricks and traps. And so one of the things that I try to do in the Windows Bible is debunk those. I mean, I tell people, this is not the Microsoft book about Windows. There's things Microsoft will not tell you about Windows because it's embarrassing. Well, I like to flaunt those things because it's where users are going to be tripped up and where they're not going to get much help from Microsoft.
Really?
Now, well, I mean, there's just those little incompatibilities or system requirements. I mean, one of the biggest laughs that I get is to look at the box, the Windows box itself in the retail store, and look at the minimum system requirements. A 286 with 1 megabyte of RAM. And, you know, I don't want to flip off bits and bytes and buzzwords here, but, I mean, a 286 with 1 megabyte of RAM, I mean, if you have the system, you should be thinking about selling it or giving it to your kids or a school or something. Certainly don't run Windows on it, because we call that crawling, not running. And so Microsoft wants to sell Windows to everybody and their brother, and they want to make the applicable systems look as broad as possible. Really, you need a 386 with 4 megabytes of RAM before you can really get the benefit out of Windows. But they don't want to say that on the box, because that would limit people's choices. So I just, in the book, I give them real guidelines for, you know, what you need to run the system and so forth. Things that Microsoft, for their own political motivations and marketing motivations, just doesn't want to be straightforward with people about.
Right. So one of the things you find out from this book is just how much speed and how much space you need before you get some real performance out of Windows. And I have seen that. I can't speak to the Microsoft advertising for minimum environment, but I have seen systems bogged down. When they get Windows on it, it seemed like the guy was spending half his day dealing with being bogged down in Windows, as opposed to doing all his work.
Well, when you place the burden on the computer of becoming people literate, you're really asking it to do something that it just can't ever handle. We do not know how people work. We know how computers work. So getting people to become computer literate, it's a struggle, but it can happen. But getting a computer to truly be people literate is an art. It's not a science. And we're progressing along the path to make that more people literate, but we're certainly not there yet. Well, it turns out to do all these things inside the computer to emulate how the human brain thinks just takes up a lot of space and a lot of power. And, you know, a lot of people, when they hear about the Pentium chip, which is the next super fast chip from Intel, they go, well, what would I ever need that for? I can barely type fast enough as it is anyway. And what they are is they're missing the point. A more powerful computer is actually easier to use. So that really the people who know the least about computers need the most powerful systems. And people think that it's just the opposite, that I'm really not that involved in it, so I need a very low-powered system, and some rocket scientist or engineer, they need that high-powered thing. Well, really, the rocket scientist knows how to type all those DOS commands, and they can get along with less power because they can put more of the struggle and stress in their brain rather than in the computer. But when you start offloading that to the computer, you really do need a robust system to sort of keep up with your own thought process.
I just can't let you go without asking you to explain to everyone why it's 3.1.
Oh, the 3.1 is the version number of Windows that is where Microsoft is in their evolution of the Windows product family. But there's a catch here. What Microsoft is doing, which is a clever thing, is they're calling all their different versions of Windows. They have Windows for Pens. They call it Windows for Pens 3.1. There's Windows for Workgroups, a special networking version, Windows for Workgroups 3.1. They're going to introduce a new super version of Windows this summer, Windows NT, version 3.1. And the reason that they're calling them all 3.1 has to do with the graphical user interface, the actual look of that interface, things like Program Manager and File Manager and the Control Panel, and the way that the interface looks. So even though there are several different versions of Windows, you can sit down at any system and it looks and acts exactly the same.
Why did you call it a Bible, and were you advised against using the term Bible?
There are some people in the religious right who become upset at that. You know, my attitude about it is that this is not meant to be a religious, spiritually redeeming work. Although, if you're sitting up late at night at 3 o'clock in the morning, you might feel that it was enlightening and that you had a revelation. But it's really not meant to be a religious work, and I think that it's an inappropriate concept to make that comparison. Really, the sort of idea that it's a Bible, that it's the book of reference, the one that you trust the most, those kinds of feelings that it's the most significant work in the field is what I was trying to get across.
Moira's guest has been Fred Davis. He's the author of the new book, The Windows 3.1 Bible, published by Peach Pit Press. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, Seal Muller, and Brian Sanders. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco Songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.